So we'll go to item seven, the J.E. Schroeder Seed Orchard and Oregon Seed Bank update. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Chair Emerson, board members, and State Forest Authority. For the record, my name is Kyle Abraham, and I serve as the Deputy Division Chief for Private Forests. Thank you for the time on the agenda today. With me is Mike Kroon, Schroeder Seed Orchard Manager, and Don Kazmarek, our geneticist in private forests. They will be providing you with a few more details about the seed orchard and Oregon Seed Bank. But before they do that, I wanted just to remind you of the several business lines that we have under private forests. So we have the field support unit, the forest health and monitoring unit, family forest land assistance program, urban and community forestry assistance program, the biomass program, and the Schroeder Seed Orchard. You guys heard about these at the October retreat. And all of these programs are housed and supported within the private forest division. So the Schroeder Seed Orchard and the Seed Bank authorities are described in statute and authorize the state forester and the state board of forestry to operate the seed bank and the seed orchard. The seed orchard and seed bank support private, industrial, federal, state, and family forest land owners in growing or making available forest tree seed, which supports the board's goals and policies, including in the forestry program for Oregon and the board's value statements. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thank you, Kyle. Chair Emerson, Board of Forestry members, Steve Forrester Doherty, for the record. Again, my name is Mike Kroon. I am the manager of the Oregon Department of Forestry's J.E. Schroeder Seed Orchard. Today, Don and I will give you a brief history of the tree improvements in Pacific Northwest and ODF's role in supporting the process, an overview of the Schroeder Seed Orchard complex, and an overview of the Oregon Seed Bank. We have provided you with packets which contain portions of the presentation today, so feel free to look through those as I give the presentation. History of tree improvement in Oregon. So to facilitate the deployment of genetically superior forest tree species, tree improvement programs in the Pacific Northwest were initiated in the late 1950s. This was a group effort of private, state, and federal partners working together to make this happen. Tree improvement of Douglas fir was the first to begin and is generally the most advanced of all the species. Other commercially important tree species which have active long-standing tree improvement programs include western hemlock, western red cedar, and ponderosa pine. After gaining support from both the Board of Forestry and the Oregon Legislature, ODF built the J.E. Schroeder Seed Orchard complex near St. Paul, Oregon in 1973 on 400 acres of land. The cooperative seed orchard allowed smaller private companies to participate in tree improvement programs where they could not support independent programs of their own. Benefits of tree improvement programs that have extended to family forest landowners in the form of available tree seed from these orchards, and Don will talk about that a little more in his presentation. The seed orchard is a unique public-private partnership that provides seed for a wide range of forest tree species in both Oregon and Washington. The total costs associated with running the orchards are incurred by members of each individual orchard, and overall goals of the orchards are determined by those members. ODF personnel are primarily responsible for the establishment, maintenance, and ongoing care of the orchards. One of the main species at this seed orchard is Douglas fir. We have excellent coverage of Douglas fir in both western Oregon and southwest Washington, with both high and low elevation orchards present at Schroeder. Some cooperators have invested in producing a Douglas fir orchard, which shows signs of tolerance to Swiss needle cast, a disease impacting the Oregon and Washington coasts. This orchard has been producing seed for several years now in the hope of planting Douglas fir seedlings resistant to Swiss needle cast on the coast. There exist three western hemlock orchards, one currently in production for the past 6 years, with coverage for western Oregon and Washington, excluding the Cascades, with both high and low elevation sources. Two younger orchards will be producing within the next 2 to 3 years. There exist three western red cedar orchards, one currently producing, with coverage for western Oregon and southwest Washington, both with coastal and inland sources. All three have been tested for high terpene levels, with the low terpene trees being removed from the orchard. Terpenes produce a bitter taste to browsing animals, and the hope is to keep them off the trees long enough to get them established in a plantation. The two younger orchards will be producing tree seed in about 5 to 6 years. We have one Willamette Valley Ponderosa Pine orchard, which is a highly productive and meeting all current demands. Willamette Valley Ponderosa Pine is a unique ponderosa pine which has adapted to the climate of the Willamette Valley. The orchard represents a collection of pine families located beginning from the southwest corner of Washington, south of Cottage Grove, then east and west across the Willamette Valley. The pine orchard is the end result of conservation efforts in the 1990s by the Willamette Valley Ponderosa Pine Conservation Association, of which ODF is a member. The Pine Association sought to conserve the species with losses due to rapid expansion in urban areas where the pine is found. So this slide is in your packet. Don't try and read it, please. Give you an idea of just the complexity of Schroeder here. Cooperators are along the left-hand side of the chart, and existing orchards at Schroeder along the top. As the manager, I've managed 26 orchards with 26 separate budgets and 23 cooperating members. My job is to keep track of these and keep them on track. Some cooperators in 1 to 2 orchards, as you can see, and others are in several orchards at Schroeder. You'll see the addition of 2 more orchards this fall and 1 more cooperator to be added to the list. As I mentioned before, we manage 400 acres of land. The land not utilized in orchards is kept in grass seed farming until needed for orchards. We switch between the two as needed. The orchards are scaled to the needs of the cooperators. They range in size from 1 acre up to 11.5 acres in some of the larger orchards. We currently have about 106 acres in orchards, and with about 40 of those acres in the stream RMA that you see at the bottom of the screen. Trials of Sitka spruce, Western red alder, Western larch are in place to see if they're compatible to grow at Schroeder and its climate there. So how do you produce seed? I guess that's the million-dollar question that most people want to know. Once the orchard is established, at age 7 we do what we call stimulation of the trees to get them to produce cones. After about a year and a half after stimulation, we hope to find the spring buds on the trees. In a photo on the left-hand side, you can see these buds. Our efforts are to produce both male and female tips on the tips of the limbs of the trees. These flowers become receptive and the pollen flows around April or so, with the final cone, fertilized cone, ready and growing by the 1st of May, after which the cone flower turns downward after being pollinated. We monitor the crop through June and July. Typically begin our harvest on the first or second week of August. Most harvest cycles last 3 to 4 weeks. Typically harvest cones when they're still in green stage rather than the brown that you see at the bottom right corner. So let's talk some advantages of seed orchard production. Orchard conditions produce seed more reliably than wild seed collections, which are sporadic at best. Uncertain growth, form, disease, and insect susceptibility of wild seed collections raise the risk of getting a crop at all. In the last 10 years, over 95% of the Douglas fir seedlings produced in the Pacific Northwest have been produced from improved seed orchards, of which Schroeder is one. As an example, a second crop on one of our orchards, a 3-acre orchard, produced over 800 bushels in 2016, which is a fantastic crop. Our orchards produce early and are highly productive. The seed orchard crop has been reliable since 2001, and with only a few or smaller crops in 2002, 2005, and 2017. The only orchard to produce a crop in 2017 was Schroeder, due to a windstorm in early April, which damaged most of the other crops in the Pacific Northwest and into Canada. We were one of the few orchards to actually produce one. The lighter bars on the graph show the pounds of seed produced in Douglas fir, and the red shows pounds of Western red hemlock. Our overall orchard acreage average is about 1/3 of a pound of bushel harvested. And those packages I'm sending around, they're about a pound each, and Western hemlock has about 240,000 seeds per pound, and Douglas fir is about 35,000 seeds per pound, just to give you an idea. So my screen is the numbers I have up there are a bit different than what I'm going to talk about here. On August 28th, or in 2018, just a few months ago, we harvested about 5,400 bushels. or about 2,200, a little over 2,200 pounds of Douglas fir seed, which can produce almost 34 million seedlings, our second largest crop in history. Additionally, in 2018, we harvested about 134 bushels of Western red cedar. In 2014, we harvested enough Western hemlock to plant 13 to 18 million seedlings. All told, the harvests are above enough to plant almost 140,000 acres of land. Some impacts from seed production, from Schroeder seed production. In total, from the time period of 2001 to 2018, seen in the earlier slide, Schroeder has produced over 20,000 pounds of Douglas fir seed alone. This is approximately 750 million, with a B, seeds during that time period. And this would produce roughly 300 million Douglas fir seedlings, enough seedlings to reforest over 750,000 acres of land. Also, large amounts of Western hemlock and Western red cedar have been harvested during that time period to produce about 60 million seedlings over that same time period. So let's for a moment talk about what it means to the forest landowner. Total impacts from Schroeder seed orchard production. Don will talk about this in a minute, but our gains are expected to be about 50% above Woods Run on a per acre basis. So if you start with a land that has 30,000 board feet to the acre, which isn't unusual on your higher producing timberland, you can expect to see another 15,000 board feet per acre on top of that. So if you take the 15,000 board feet and you multiply this by the 750,000 acres of seed we've produced, you're looking at about 11 billion seedlings that you could potentially produce. At today's market, 11 billion board feet that could be potentially produced off this improved seed. At today's market, let's say $800 per MBF, that equates to about $8.8 billion that could be put into the market into the future, with further increases in value seen throughout the chain as finished products are produced.
Thank you very much. My name is Don Kaczmarek, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I'm going to give a little bit more information about the tree improvement process we have in place, and then give you more specific information about the Oregon Seed Bank. Just to cover a little bit about what we're doing, all the work we do at Schroeder is actually done through traditional breeding. So we're not doing any GMO work, no genetic engineering. It's all traditional breeding methods. And we look at several specific traits we're trying to increase. One of the things we always want to have is the trees that we're producing, or the seedlings we're producing to produce the seeds, we want to make sure that they have broad adaptability to the areas that we're going to be deploying that area. We're also looking at a suite of other traits that we want to try to improve. Increased growth rate is always something we're looking at. We also are looking at potentially increased insect or disease resistance. As Mike mentioned, for Douglas fir, one of the breeding programs we have in place is for breeding for increased tolerance to Swiss needle cast disease. So that's something that we've made good progress on, and we now have an orchard that is producing Swiss needle cast tolerant seed. So it allows us to go into those Swiss needle cast zones a little bit more confidently without having real large negative impacts of Swiss needle cast. We're also trying to generally breed for increased or stable wood quality. We want to make sure as we try to produce trees that are growing faster, we're not getting large sacrifices in wood quality. And as Mike mentioned, one of the other things we're looking at with Western red cedar is trying to increase the terpene levels of the material. Higher terpene is less attractive to into browsers, elk and deer. So if you can increase your terpene levels of your seedlings, they become less attractive, preferably getting your browse animals targeting other areas. Western red cedar without protection or other ways of trying to discourage to browse can make it very hard to regenerate cedar successfully. So that's one of the programs we have in place to try to address some of those issues. So what are the advantages of improved seed? As Mike mentioned, we're trying to improve all those characteristics we just listed. But anytime you have any population of trees or any animals for that instance, you will have a range of traits. Generally, all the traits in a population will be on a U-shaped curve, if you will. What you find on those type of situations, try to illustrate what we have within a given set of traits in a given population. This would be a wild collection of Douglas fir seed. So you'll have a distribution of traits. If we're looking at, for instance, growth here, you'll have a few trees illustrated in dark green that are very fast growing or very high growth potential. You have a certain percentage of that will be yellow, which will be moderately good to good growth. You'll have a lot of trees in the middle, moderate potential, and you'll have a few on the tail end for slow to very slow growth. And if a landowner deploys that population, this is something like you can get. This is here 100 trees, but you can think of this as 1,000 or 10,000 or 100 acres or 1,000 acres. You'll find in any of those populations, you'll have a few very good trees, a lot of mediocre trees, and then a few very, very poor trees. With the tree improvement processes, what we're doing over time, in this case, going from a woods run collection to a first generation collection, will essentially shift this entire curve to the right. So what you look at on the ground then, we'll get more trees with good performance levels and try to get fewer and fewer over time that have very poor to moderately poor performance. If we go to the second generation, you get further increases, further shifts to the right of the curve, and then we get more and more high quality trees and fewer numbers of lesser quality trees. And in this case, we can think of this as growth, but if depending what we're selecting for, this could also be thought of as also disease resistance. So if you think about it in the natural population here, if we're looking at resistance to disease like Swiss needle pass, you'll find a few individuals in the natural population that have higher resistance. But as you go through and put selection pressure on that trait of interest, you'll get continual improvement. In this case, it's in two generations. Where we are right now with most of our tree improvement programs on the west side of the Cascades, most of those programs are actually, we're breeding the third generation right now. So that allows us to put an emphasis on what traits we're trying to breed for the future and carry forward. So it gives us a tremendous amount of power to increase our desired traits in the future. To illustrate where we are or where we have been and where we're trying to go, this is actually one of our first generation orchards at Schroeder. This is what we call our Nehalem seed orchard. This is a first generation orchard. This basically is kind of the northwest Oregon area. So a lot of the seed would go to the Tillamook districts, Astoria districts, and to a limited extent in Forest Grove, but primarily Astoria and Tillamook. And what we have here on the x-axis, you have all the families that are actually in that seed orchard. And what we have on the y-axis is the gain levels of those individual families. So at age 11, the fastest growing family in that orchard is giving us about a 62% volume gain over woods run material. What we have is basically a third. So the top third of the families in that orchard are giving us about a 35% or higher volume gain at age 11. The middle third are giving us about 20 to 35%. And then on the tail end here, you have the slow growing families that are giving us growth less than 20%. And on the very low tail end, you actually have a few families that are growing slower than a general woods run collection. And generally when we try to manage these orchards, we would rogue some of these poor performing individuals out. We wouldn't try to produce seed for those, and we wouldn't necessarily want pollen contamination in our orchard. So what we're really, when we try to deploy the seed, we're generally deploying on the top end of the curve. So this material is preferentially put out to landowners. And then if we have a limited supply, we'll go a little bit lower in the tail. But this is really what we're trying to do, put families that have the desired traits that we're looking for on the landscape. So where do we put these trees? Well, as Mike mentioned, the history of tree improvement Douglas fir in the Pacific Northwest goes back to the 1950s. And if you look at it, the Pacific Northwest in total, there's been over 31,000 families that have been tested at some point. Literally millions of individuals have been in various progeny tests. So when we try to locate the best trees to carry forward in our programs, there's a huge base that we test off of. Early on in the tree improvement process, there were 46 separate seed zones just in western Oregon. With the additional testing in the first and early part of the second generation, those earlier seed zones were condensed into 16 different seed zones, still a wide range of seed zones. And one of the things we found as we continue to test, you probably have greater ability to deploy the best material over a wider land base than you otherwise would. And as I mentioned now, we're basically in the second gen orchards that are starting to produce seed. Right now we have five different orchards, or actually six different orchards, but these different color zones that are currently producing second gen seed for these areas. And we put in one orchard here just last week that'll be essentially the Roseburg low elevation, and we'll pick up the Roseburg Cascade next year. So within a couple of years, we'll have all this area, we'll have second-gen orchards in place to produce seed, and as Mike said, in about 6 or 7 years at most. And now we're breeding the third gen. So the work we're doing now for the breeding work in a few years will carry through, and we'll have even better material to deploy on the landscape. So the question is then, one of the things, obviously we have, as Mike said, 26 different cooperators in our orchards, 26 different orchards. The Oregon Seed Bank is really a unique structure that allows a lot of the advantages of this improved seed, all this leverage work that's been put into breeding, to be actually extended to family forest landowners. The Oregon Seed Bank has the ability to purchase seed from any of the orchards that's been established at Schroeder, and then we make that seed preferentially available to family forest landowners. Make sure that the best genetic material that we have available is out on the landscape. We also have the ability to purchase seed from outside sources to make it available where there isn't orchard seed. We obviously, from Schroeder itself, don't cover all of Oregon. So parts of eastern Oregon, ponderosa pine, a lot of the other species, western larch, we purchase seed on the open market from wild collections to meet those needs. We also have unique partnerships with several federal organizations that do breeding work, and they are unable to sell seed directly to landowners, but we have intergovernmental agreements to purchase seed that's produced there. And then getting this really elite genetic material out on the landscape, we're able to resell it to family forest landowners. So we have that program with sugar pine, western white pine, where we can bring in blister rust resistant material into the our seed bank and then make that seed available. We also have similar work with Port Orford Cedar, where we have bring in root rot resistant selections from Port Orford Cedar that the Forest Service has worked with, and we make that seed available. So the idea is to get broadly adaptable, strong performing genotypes available to everyone who needs a seed. So essentially we want to make sure that when we deploy these trees on the landscape, they become a long-term asset, not just for timber production, but all the traits that we're looking for. We don't want maladapted seed on the market and then deploy that becomes a long-term liability that we're going to have to deal with for the next 20 to 50 years. So we're trying to extend those benefits to anybody who needs it. So one of the things we do, there's certainly been an issue of seedling availability. We work a lot with private landowners who are looking for seed sources, so we do a lot of outreach with that. We also publish annually the seedling catalog, which talks about different topics that are of interest to landowners who are trying to reforest. And then we also list seedling availability. Seedling supplies have been very, very tight the last few years. We try to do a lot of education with small landowners about the need for pre-planning, that you really need to start planning about 2 years before you need your seedlings. So you really need to start thinking about seedlings before you do your harvest. So if we can do that, I think it certainly gives us benefit. We also have all this on the webpage, both the this type of material, educational material, and then also the seed listings. And there's been a high demand for seed certainly the last few years. And we've really had, I think, really good luck at moving seed on the outside. Last year in 2017, we sold over 180 pounds of seed to landowners. That was enough to produce about 6.6 million seedlings. Range of species, 7 different species, obviously Douglas fir, western hemlock, western red cedar, ponderosa pine was a major species, a little bit of incense cedar, Port Orford cedar. So a real nice mix of trees that we have. So we try to meet the demands that are out there. When we can, we try to educate small landowners, and we really try to make sure that we're really getting the best genetic material that we have available at any given point to try to make these things, again, a long-term asset on our landscape. Thank you very much. If anybody has any questions, either Mike and I will be certainly glad.
Yeah. So really neat work and really good to see. Sort of my theme of the day seems to be climate change. I just had some help from someone who's intimately involved with it. Sounds like most of the commercial harvest, we're looking at a tree that's planted today, likely not to be harvested for like another 60 years in there somewhere, you know, somewhere in there. So that's clearly in the realm of impacts from climate change. And so I'm wondering sort of what specifically are you doing related to that? I'd say your disease resistance is right down that line because those stresses are likely to increase.
Right. And one of the things, one of the real strengths of our program, of the orchard program, is the orchard itself is really at the top-notch location. We've got construction work. But the other thing is we link that work with the breeding work. ODF is actively involved and a really integral member in a lot of these tree improvement programs. I didn't list them all, but we're certainly in tree improvement programs for hemlock. We're in multiple breeding zones for Douglas fir, and we're doing for the North Coast, which is basically from Newport to Astoria and from the coast into the foothills of the Coast Range, about 80% of the breeding work. And one of the things we are doing with all this work is, well, about 75% of it is primarily local crosses. So material, Astoria cross with Astoria, Astoria with Tillamook, pretty local. But we have brought in a little bit wider range of crosses in all the breeding programs. So for instance, there's a South Central Coast material cross with North Coast. So that would be things like Gold Beach or Coos Bay, crossed with some of the local Astoria or Tillamook families. Now, you know, conceptually that seems like it might have advantages, but the real strength of the program is you really thoroughly test that. It may work really well, it may not. If it works really well, we'll find it out in 5 or 10 years. If it doesn't work really well, then, you know, that's a dead end, but we've got an awful lot of other things to carry forward. On the hemlock front, we've brought in germplasm actually from Northern California, kind of the southern extremity of the hemlock range. So that's being crossed with more Tillamook or Astoria families. So those, over time, over the next 10 or 20 years, we'll see how those wider range crosses. They may be more adapted to a changing climate.
So the disease resistance, obviously, is a suite of traits that you can look for. Are you also looking at, like, temperature and drought tolerance?
Not directly, but what we do when we put the tests out, we look at a range of site types. So we have some that are very close to the coast that tend to have lower moisture stress. Then we take more inland sites. So one of the things that we'd look at, and besides just growth is kind of an integrative factor, but we also look at survivability. So if something is very drought prone, that family may drop out at a higher percentage than something that tolerates that more so. So we don't necessarily impose drought on these things, but we try to get a range of test sites that allow that stress to be
imposed.
Stressed, yes.
Yeah.
There's Don, myself, and three others, and then two of them at part time. Yeah. Well, of course, yeah. So when we have the larger amounts of work, like the cone harvest and the processing, that the processing gets shipped out and they do that. The cone harvest is a contractor that comes in and does it. But the remaining work is just the five of us.
And you will kind of see that indirectly because we can look at the data when we collect it. And typically you'll see things that are the survival's 90, 95% on a family. If you see a family that the survival has dropped down to 60%, even if the growth is pretty good on that, we probably are going to look pretty closely at what's going on there. It's probably not going to be a selection we're going to carry forward. Some of those things will stick out.
I had a chance to go up into Okanagan, up into BC this last year. Have you familiar with the work the Canadians are doing with climate change and moving species around? Have you seen their work? It's pretty fascinating.
Yes.
They're doing a lot of work planting species intentionally offsite, in the southern parts, all the way down into California and stuff, and looking at, and obviously different species have different adaptability. Ponderosa pine being one that's very movable, very elastic. Some trees are extremely elastic. They can be planted in a variety of different, drought conditions and so on, and others not. But, and the Canadians are actually pushing, it's what they're finding. They're not actually restrict, they're moving their seed zones north. So moving larch into areas they've never planted Western larch to, or tamarack. And so anyway, I'd encourage you to look at what they're doing. They're way ahead of the curve on looking at some of that stuff. Also, they're doing a lot of research with disease resistance, actually resistance to bark beetles, bark beetle attack, tip weevils, and so on. Fascinating research they're doing up there.
Sort of finish up this discussion. The other thing that's interesting, you know, you're shifting distribution of genetic traits, and I've been involved. My only connection, even as remotely associated with this, is associated with fish hatchery analysis and similar kinds of things, where in that instance, many of the fish hatcheries unintentionally shifted genetic traits without realizing the repercussions of that shift. And I'm assuming you're looking and dealing with that, and particularly also dealing with maintaining the maximum flexibility, because we may think we know what we need in a climate change future, but we may be wrong.
With all this work, we have what we consider a deployment population, then we have a long-term breeding population. And actually, when you look at the breeding programs, they're fairly conservative. So the way they're designed, if you were less conservative, you probably could try to focus a little more on traits of like growth traits, and you probably sacrifice some diversity if you try to really absolutely maximize growth. The programs here are fairly conservative with the idea they are designed for long-term ability to go in, so they're trying to control inbreeding, try to have a large enough genetic base to really breed for 20 or 30 generations. And when you think of a generation of a tree species of, you know, 20 to 30 years, you're breeding for 20 or 30 generations is an awful long time. So it is very conservative. And our orchards themselves tend to be fairly conservative. So we do put out a pretty diverse range of genotypes on the landscape. Our orchards will have anywhere from on the very low end of 20 to 30 families, on the high end, sometimes 80 or 90 families. So the diversity there is still very nice, very high. Yeah, that definitely is possible. So yeah, we we do keep all these, well, certainly not all, but not 31,000, but we keep a good conservative amount of those trees in reserves, clone banks. They're either conserved in or ex situ in clone banks, so we can go back there if we find something that, if you had a good instance, if you had an extreme weather event and you had high mortality on a given site type, but there were a few families that were resistant, you could go back there and try to locate which those families are, and that might be something you want to bring in the future.
Mills?
Just very quickly, you kind of answered my question that I was going to ask, and that is, it seems important to maintain genetic variability in your population so that when unexpected things come up, you have something to draw from to be able to address those, and also to maintain some of the ecologically important traits in a forest that you might want to work
with. And one of the other advantages, as you increase some of the breeding zones from very small size, when there were 46 seed zones, you almost had a lot of the seed zones were almost the size of counties. That's really hyper diversification. So as you got a little bit larger, you're bringing trees together that are unrelated, and you're also putting together new combinations of genes that may be more adaptable to changing conditions. So there are strengths there. And everything is really backed up with very strong replicated tests. That's really the key. You don't just make the crosses and assume they're going to be good because you crossed southern material. You really have to verify that those are the traits that really are giving you the adaptive traits you're looking for.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So I'd like to thank everybody who participated here today. The board will now have an executive session pursuant to ORS 192-6602H for the purpose of conferring with legal counsel regarding the board's rights and duties related to current litigation or litigation likely to be filed. No decision will be made in executive session, and at the end of the executive session, the board meeting will adjourn, so we won't be back today. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. Are we headed to?
Yeah, in 5 minutes. Five minutes, we'll meet in the Tillamook room. What? Clatsop, sorry.
Clatsop.
Yeah.
That's our legal room. Seems like that's all. Yeah.